Okay, so at this time, I'd like to call up our second panel, which is being moderated by Professor Eric Tang. Eric Tang is the CUNY Thomas Tam Visiting Professor, and we've had the honor of working with him this year at ARRI. And he's been doing some wonderful work throughout the community. The topic of this panel is Solidarity in Action, Lessons Learned. And I will leave it to him to introduce the panelists or to have the panelists introduce themselves. I think that this is an extremely valuable panel, building on the first panel and the comments that we heard from the keynote speaker as well. So, Eric, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How are you? Thanks for being here, and thank you, Joyce, and to all the wonderful organizers of this conference. It's my pleasure to moderate this second panel, which looks at the question of solidarity. Solidarity is at the heart of the Asian American project. There isn't really an Asian America to talk about without the notion of solidarity, because it really was born out of this moment 50 years ago, if you want to be more precise, 47 and a half years ago, when young Asian activists of different ethnicities decided to forge this political identity, Asian America. And they forged it because they were participating in solidarity movements with African Americans and Latinos and Native Americans. And they said, you know, we're participating as non-whites in these broader civil rights and liberation movements. Does it make sense for us to also think of ourselves as a common racial category? And out of this movement moment, 1968-69, the term Asian American was born. Okay, so solidarity is at the root of Asian American politics. And what I love about the panel we've assembled this afternoon is they exemplify the best of that Asian American movement. And what I mean by that is they're engaged in solidarity politics, but not just as a slogan, not just as a sentiment, but through on-the-ground organizing work day to day. And that's really how solidarity is forged. So the question that's going to structure our conversation today is, what do those on-the-ground activities look like? Right? What are people doing today to keep this notion of solidarity alive? Before I introduce the panel, I want to just maybe say one thing about why Asian America or Asian American is 50 years old. Why isn't it 70 years old? Why isn't it 80 years old for that matter? Why isn't it 10 years old? What happened during the late 1960s that allowed for this identity to emerge? And to explain that, I'm going to cite one of our venerated sociologists upstairs. Her name is Frances Fox Piven. Have you guys heard of Frances Fox Piven? See, yes, someone has. Pick up her work. Check her out. She wrote a wonderful book with her long-term partner, Richard Cloward, called Poor People's Movements. And that came out, I think, in 1974, if I'm not mistaken. And in it, she introduces us to this important theory about how and when certain movements take off, right? So we kind of are familiar with, like, the 60s, right? Things erupted during the 60s. And then, you know, again, maybe during the 90s, during the 1930s, things erupted. And the question is, why during these moments? And what she says is that there are these moments of social dislocation, right? Moments of crisis where those in power feel vulnerable. Things are not what they thought there's not business as usual. And so during the late 1960s, you see this moment of crisis where you have the Vietnam War, You have the passage of civil rights, but then also the white backlash against civil rights. You have African Americans in cities who are realizing that the Civil Rights Act of 64 really didn't do much for their entrenched poverty. And so this moment of crisis, or this social dislocation moment, emerges. And during that moment, certain groups that are already organizing for years emerge, right? And they take advantage of that moment of vulnerability among the elites. And 1968-69 was that moment, where there were all these Asian Americans who decided this is our moment to come out and to take it to the streets and to be part of a broader anti-establishment movement. But it's not as if these groups just were born overnight. They were doing work for years, if not decades, leading up to 68-69. So what Professor Piven argues is that we can't produce these moments of social dislocation. That's out of our control. These moments just come, right? We can't predict them. We can't manufacture them. But what we can do is we can build the vehicles on the ground that are ready to take advantage of that moment when it arises. Does that make sense? And so the people we've assembled today are building these vehicles on the ground, day to day. They're not always going to be, you know, in movement moment. But they're doing the important work that when this moment of crisis emerges, this moment of social dislocation, they can jump on it, right? And without them, we don't have a movement. And so that's the framework with which I want to, build today's discussion. And without further ado, let me just briefly introduce at least the names of our panelists. And their biographies are in the program, and you could read them. And they're lengthy biographies because they're accomplished speakers and activists. So we have Chaya Chaum, who is executive director of Mekong NYC, based in the Bronx. You can clap too if you want. We have Kazi Fauzia with Desi's Rising Up and Moving. We have Kathy Dang with CAV, Organizing Asian Communities. And last but not least, Kalyan Mendoza with Amnesty International. What's remarkable is this is such a youthful panel, and they are young and they look young, but there's almost a century worth of work among all of these folks, two decades, of working in organizations both here and elsewhere. So we're really honored to have all of them. I'm going to do this as a roundtable discussion. I'm going to pose a question. Everyone's going to get a chance to hit on it and then move on to the next round before opening it up to all of you. Okay, so how are you guys doing?
Good.
Right? So the first question I guess I want to pose is, where is or what is the state of solidarity, political solidarity, today with respect to your work in Asian communities and beyond? And maybe tied to that, what does solidarity even mean in this moment? So we can begin with Kathy, if you don't mind, and just move down the line. Will that work?
Sure. I was going to suggest we don't start the line by
talking. Okay, well, we can go with whoever feels just like I've been dying to answer this question all week.
That's all we think about.
That's all you think about, yeah. So you could... Does anyone want to jump on it?
I mean, I don't mind.
Okay, well, it's going to be Kathy. Okay.
Okay. Well... Yeah, it's quite the moment, and CAV coming out of last year, when we were doing the work to support the family of Akai Gurley, we've had to really just get a stronger hold of what solidarity looks like and what it actually means, what the movement needs of us to really perform solidarity. And so for us, what solidarity looks like in defining that is it's the directly impacted people whose voices we uplift. And you should be able to visibly see that in action. So when we do police accountability work, when we're at the marches here in New York, It's actually the families who are the very front, first, and centered people who we uplift. It's Black communities. Black and brown communities are the very front. MEMSA communities were at the very front. And Asian communities, and then white allies who are in the very back to support and uplift the families in the very front. And when you look and imagine that the families at the very, very front, the mother of Marley Graham, of Eric Gardner, the aunt of Akai Gurley and Chantel Davis, all these families are at the very front, and that's very crucial to show to the world who we need to center. And so when we talk about solidarity, it really means that we uplift those voices. And last year we had our 30th anniversary gala, and one of our longtime, a mentor to us, Lumumba, he says solidarity is a verb. You know, we have to act and perform in solidarity. So it's not just putting out a statement, it's actually showing up in what ways you can, writing those postcards, showing up to the airport at these actions. Solidarity is a verb. You know, throw down money and support organizations. You know, it's great ACLU got a lot of donations, but it's actually the smaller grassroots organizations who are leading the work on the ground, like DRUM, the organizations like AROC. So it's, you know, putting your money also there to support them. That's solidarity too. And for us, when you know, we support the family of Akai Gurley, who was killed by former NYPD officer Peter Liang, and Peter Liang was one of the first officers to be indicted in a very long time when white officers weren't held accountable. And we directly supported the family of Akai Gurley. And that also conflicted with our membership. And it was a really challenging year to get through that. But, you know, in the end, coming out of last year, our biggest lesson that we learned, the best thing we can do to show solidarity is moving our communities, is to win material gains, to earn the trust of the people who need to be moved in our base, so that we can show up and show true solidarity. And that's what the movement requires of us. So that's the work that we're doing now, is doing political education with our immigrant working class base to build that connection to systemic violence, that whether they're a tenant or a youth, that same system that pushes them out of their home is the same system that is killing Black folks every 20 hours in this country. And we have to change the system as one collective. So I'll stop there.
I guess we'll just go down. And then we're going to bring you first, the next question.
Right. Oh, that's fair.
Right? I think 100 years on this panel,
I don't
really?
Know. I'm just, you know, I'm just 20, maybe.
So I think I agree with what Kathy put out, and I think so I organized the Vietnamese and Cambodian community in the Bronx, and, you know, a lot of us came after the Vietnam War and the fall of the Khmer Rouge regime. So that history has created the organizing model that Mekong and that relationship to the United States has been shaped how we do movement work and organizing work. And I'll share in more details around what that looks like on the ground. But I think solidarity is really transformative, right? So part of it is about knowing when to show up and when to not show up. And it is one of those, I remember, you know, when we were asked to, to show up at a rally in the Bronx, in the South Bronx, and making some really hard decisions whether or not we should, because our base was in such a turmoil around, we weren't prepared as our membership to show up in solidarity. And what I mean by that is that our base wasn't necessarily ready, where the movement was at. Their analysis wasn't ready. And particularly for Southeast Asians, I'll share experience around why it is hard for people to show up sometimes. And our job as leaders, and, you know, we're all wounded warriors in some sense, you know, and like all of us have experienced state violence, sexual violence, and all kinds of different violence that, and in poverty, you know, living in poverty. So for my community, one of the most profound things I've learned over the years was actually a conversation we had at a meeting, and one of the community members came up to us after and was like, you know, I experience violence every day from Black and brown people, and you want me to show up for them. How do you do that? And for me, it was like, well, you know, for me as like an organizer, the theory and analysis is like pushing us to do that, right? To show up. But then our base wasn't even there. It was one of the saddest moments in my organizing history, but also one of the most profound moments, because what I realized is that as displaced people,
you know, who were inserted into urban poverty, and for people who came to the United States because of militarization, because of war, that we actually understand what it means like to, in the front line, in your home country, being killed by black, brown people and your own people, and then being in the refugee camps, being saved by white UN workers, and then coming to the ghettos of the Bronx, being robbed and beaten up by black people. So that was something that we as an organization needed to address. Well, how do we do that internal work of building resistance in our community consciousness, but really about building community and being transformative about how we show up in solidarity? Because just for the sake of showing up for us doesn't work, because we know that at the end of the day, our people are not there, right? So that's something that we continue to work with. And organization like DRUM and CAV has always been engaging folks in political engagement, and we continue to do the same.
Thank you, sir. Eric already mentioned, my name is Kazi Fozi. I work with DRUM. DRUM basically organized South Asian low-income working class people. 60% of members we organize are undocumented community from South Asia. So when we talk solidarity, DRUM actually doing a couple of like level of solidarity, I mean verbal solidarity, when we sign letter or petition or support any kind of movement, transactional solidarity and transformational solidarity. So I'm going to give three examples, then it's very easy to understand what does mean solidarity for us. So when the Rana Plaza building collapsed in Bangladesh, 1,100 people died, 2,500 people are injured. Our members here, working class, undocumented, retail worker, restaurant worker, who actually get $3 or $5 per hour's wages here, they came up, say, we have to do something. They did protest and rally here to hold accountable the retailers and demand compensation and building safety, collect money. They don't collect from other people. They collect from each other, and they collect good amount of money and send back home for injured workers. So I can call this kind of solidarity maybe really low level solidarity for the movement. And the second example I want to give, what Kathy already mentioned, when our black kids killed by police and mom in the street, so we don't stay our home, and also we don't write letter or petition. Our undocumented mom also go with them in the police plaza. Sometimes we are 200, they are 500. They almost get out of us, but we don't care. It's not we are very activists want to be arrested, but we don't want actually black mom live alone in the police when they demand justice for their kids. Our undocumented people are also scared, arrested, or any kind of deportation or detention, but they took that kind of risk to support black mom, because this is really, really need to stand with them that time. So another kind of solidarity, if I want to example, the Muslim ban. When Muslim ban happened, the first day we did not go with our undocumented people. We go with who have a green card, who have a citizen. And when our members saw in the news, we are in the JFK, they asked, why you did not ask us to go with us? We said, no, you cannot go for the authority, do the protest. This is very risk. And they say, we want to take the risk. We are not those seven countries, but what? We are the Muslim. We are immigrant. We are color of people. We will be target maybe second time. So we don't want to stay until we target. We have to go. And second day they showed up. And very high level of solidarity when we call transformations, transformal solidarity. This is something I can give you example when CIR came. Maximum our South Asian undocumented member actually will be eligible if something passed. We discuss a lot. We do political education. What is the risk? What is the opportunity, not opportunity? And 3 or 4 our leaders say, hey, just reject this. We don't want. We don't want any kind of immigration referred cost of Latino people in the border. So this is solidarity mean for us and our membership. We don't want any kind of benefit, whose benefit came from other people's blood.
Hey, y'all. How's everyone doing? So I inhabit a very different space where I'm not actually working with the directly impacted community. Our base at Amnesty International USA is predominantly white folks, white middle upper class folks. And one of the things that I try to expound with our membership is solidarity is power with, not power over. What does that mean? Power with means actually listening to the community, listening to the leadership of that community. It means decentering yourself within the within that space. It means this ain't about you, boo-boo. If this does not affect you directly, if you are not from the affected community, you need to move back. You need to assess where you're at, and you need to assess what resources you can bring to the table. Solidarity is about sacrifice, and for a lot of folks of privilege, especially white folks, it's difficult to sacrifice their need to always be the one to speak, to provide strategy, to talk about, you know, oh, I have all of this experience, and I went to this school, you know what, chill out. A lot of it's about learning the value of silence. If you're not going to improve upon the silence, just, you know, STF you. So it's really, I get the fun job of helping to develop white people's analysis around building an anti-oppression lens. And what I've seen in the past almost 8 years at Amnesty is folks come in with white savior complex. They've been told all their life that they need to save these brown people from, you know, dictators. It's like, nah, they can save themselves. Like Arundhati Roy said, there's no such thing as a voiceless people. There are people who have had their voices taken from them. So really instilling with white folks that their job is to move back and to really figure out what can they bring to the table, whose voices, as Kathy said, need to be uplifted, and what resources do they need to bring. So
I'm going to move on to the next question, and we're going to unfairly begin with you, Kalyan, and move down the line at Chai's suggestion, but it's actually it's a good way to start, because I want to pick up on the last thing you said, which is, you know, this is not about a charitable exercise, right, where you're going to, you know, give somebody something that they don't have, and that is solidarity. But on the other hand, you also use the term uplifting their voices, right? So what is a concrete example of not engaging in, like, this patronizing, paternalistic charity, but at the same time, empowering, which sounds almost the same thing. So for all of us, the whole panel, what's an example concretely that has worked historically or even now where it's about solidarity that isn't power over, uplifting, which isn't patronizing?
I might get fired for this, but whatever. Donate to organizations on this side of the table. Give your money and resources to grassroots organizations that are doing the frontline work on the ground. It's wonderful that multinational organizations are able to do the work, but real talk, the real work is happening with orgs like Drum, like Mekong NYC, and CAV, that are working with very little resources but doing an immense amount of impact. It's about giving up that privilege. It's about giving up that power. And really starting to decentralize yourself as the only recipient of resources, whether that means media hits, whether that means, and I'm talking from a very nonprofit industrial complex view, but looking at what transformational solidarity means to you as if you're part of an organization, making sure to really center and support the folks on the ground that are doing the real work.
Thank you. So when we say the past example, the history, when actually Eric sent me The question before, I tried to learn actually the South Asian and British colonial history. Anything we did that time, the solidarity or some kind of history, I didn't find, sorry to say, because we only fight for our freedom, not other people that time. So when I come back here in USA, I find something. Recent time, our community had a lot of conversation. Oh, black kids are bears, black kids suspend more, so and so. The lot of good job in our hand now, black people out of the system and oppressed and marginalized, their kids out of school. Every kind of sacrifices they are still doing. But they probably know that time also when they did civil rights movement, but they introduced native voting rights, they include native voting rights, they include Asian Conclusion Act, they take risks. They include us to come this country and do the work, do the job, do our education when they almost out of everything now. So this is the great lesson in mind, actually, how people do the solidarity work, take a risk and do work for other people, make sure other people freedom also got. And if I want to give you the very recent example, I want to definitely give example CAP. When go to court and support Akai Garli family, they actually go against their own community. This is a big risk. As an organization, organizer, everything. So this is actually such a good lesson how we can do real solidarity with other community and other people.
Yesterday I was just coming out of a meeting with Bronx Lebanon Hospital. So Mekong is actually working with the Martin Luther King Health Center of the Bronx Lebanon Hospital to open the first Southeast Asian clinic in the Bronx led by Southeast Asian people. That alone, I know that sentence may seem really weird and obscure and like, how that happened? And, you know, I was thinking about it yesterday and I was like, wow, 30, 40 years from now, what are the lessons to learn from this collaboration? And why under the Martin Luther King legacy are we opening this clinic? So there's many reasons why, but I think one of the things, what we realize is that we were actually, when we started engaging the hospitals and communities in the Bronx around mental health issues, particularly around PTSD and trauma and intergeneration trauma as it relates to Southeast Asian people, we realized as we were having a conversation with people, like the everyday violence that people in our community were experiencing was also very similar to what our people had experienced, right? And then that's when we started making the connection around this historical intergenerational trauma around how DNA, our DNA trauma is embedded in our DNA. So having conversations with black, brown people around this and around our own experience with trauma and naming PTSD was something that was really transformative in our work. And right now we're training the entire institution, Bronx Lebanon, around organizing, transformative organizing, and also what it means to be standing in solidarity with each other. And that they're, them as an institution engaging with us is a form of solidarity for us, because they, not only are they helping us support its development, they're also putting resources. And that was one thing that I was nervous to ask about in the beginning, but then I was like, well, you need to fund three of our staff to do this work. And so they are. And this is the kind of process that I think in 20 years we have to, as an organization, as a community, still need to process what's going on. But I think it talks about how, you know, in these moments of displacement and dislocation, that there's also a lot of trauma that's connected into this, right? So that if we don't talk about the trauma of our community and also talk about the anti-Asian violence and like the way the Asian minority, we had to educate the entire staff around like anti-Asian stuff.
you know, and like anti-immigrant rhetoric. And for us, that was a very transformative moment because we didn't, it was a shared experience with all the staff, particularly the staff of color, all wanted this clinic so bad for us. You know, and then for us, in return, we said this is actually going to be a model for not just the Bronx, hopefully, well, not just our section of the Bronx, but the entire Bronx around how does community, two oppressed community come together and build something for each other, right? And this is, it's like the actual manifestation. I'm still like, you know, processing all of this, like we're going to open officially on June 24th, but I'll share that one of the first meeting with the VP of Bronx Lebanon, a women's circle, about 30 of them, met with them and said, we need women's services in that clinic now. Because they were hearing from the other immigrant community, particularly Bangladeshi women, African immigrant women, and said they took the women's services out. So they even said, before we even have this clinic, we want the women's services to come back. And that was the first thing we asked for, not even for our clinic. So that process alone had been really transformative for us, and hoping that we can shape and shift the model minority myth, the anti-immigrant sentiment, but also talking about what Black liberation looks like and what the legacy of Martin Luther King looked like in our narrative. To talk about even anti-Blackness and colorism in our community. That's something that, you know, building this clinic helped us do, and doing it with other community of color. And the clinic is going to be called the Beloved Community for many reasons. But we're really excited about how transformative and this project is going to be. And we're going to see 20 years. We'll see what it looks like.
Could you ask the question again? Sorry.
Yeah. So, if solidarity is not about charity, right? Oh, I have, you know, this abundance of rights or resources, and I'm going to lift you out of your hole of oppression. Then, and if it's really about, you know, empowering, but from an equal position, how does that actually look? You know, like, are there good concrete examples we could draw on to illustrate that type of solidarity?
Okay. I can give a couple of examples. So I don't know how many of you in here, maybe the older folks might remember Mark Wahlberg and his, when he attacked two Vietnamese youth and a Black youth, and he actually blinded one of the men, the Vietnamese men. And I think a year ago or two, he was trying to lift his felony conviction off his record. And Cav had organized around the Mark Wahlberg campaign. I think you were in some of those pictures. So like reporters called us and asked for our statement. And I was like, honestly, I probably was 9 years old dancing to Marky Mark, back then. I have to refer to our newsletters, say anything. So I actually didn't, I deferred to the family. The people who were directly impacted, who were beaten by Mark Wahlberg, the survivors of that violence, they are the people to best comment on his conviction, and whether they would want to give him forgiveness. It's actually not on Cav or myself, who wasn't even around at that time, to give any commentary about that situation and whether he should be able to have his felony lifted. So that's one clear example is, you know, organizations don't speak for everybody, and if in any case we uplift our members and our staff who do the work on the ground and have them speak to reporters, have them be the storytellers of the work. One clear example is, so we're really close with Picture the Homeless. They're an amazing organization that does grassroots organizing of homeless folks in New York City. And Picture the Homeless and CAV are often the two organizations in the room who are so radical, and that the housing movement won't listen to us because we are too idealistic in our strategies, which we disagree with. Mm-hmm. You know, when we're in situations, in our membership, we do mutual solidarity, where Picture the Homeless members have come down to Chinatown and have done actions with our members. And we've showed up at one police plaza when the mayor was trying to do sweeps on the subways around the winter. It's mutual solidarity. But then in citywide spaces around housing policies and demands, we can't forget to leave out the homeless folks in New York City, because we won't win, our rent-stabilized tenants won't win justice until Black homeless folks in New York City win too. And, you know, I just want to share a story. We had an action in front of one of our landlords, Ari Cohen, on Eldridge Street, and it was really, you know, it was the first time I experienced this, but the tenants were having a rally in front of the landlords, in front of their building. And a Black man comes by and is like screaming, like, you know, the landlords won't even take my Section 8 vouchers. He was homeless. The landlords don't even take their vouchers. And so recognizing that there are levels in this work of perspective that, yes, the conditions are actually very horrible for horrendous for our tenants, horrendous, to the point where we had one building where the tenants didn't have hot water, gas, or electricity for 3 weeks in December and January. That's horrendous. The landlord intentionally shut it off to kick them out. But recognizing that in most situations, there are homeless folks all over New York. And so we're in these policy discussions with citywide spaces. We always, you know, we want to call picture the homeless into the room. Then they're the ones speaking to their campaigns, and they're the ones sharing these spaces, but moving the path forward to make sure that we recognize that we need to include homeless folks in the conversation around housing. So those are two clear examples. And the last thing I wanted to share about this is that, you know, when we were doing the work with the family of Akai Gurley, there are many moments that we would only speak only if, and most times, I mean, the family wanted us to speak with them. But there are also many times that we didn't want to speak. We didn't want to be in the front. We didn't want to be clearly visible, because it's actually the families who should be clearly visible. It's frontline communities who should be clearly visible. And we take risks. You know, we lose some for the greater push towards humanity. And that's what solidarity requires of us. We have to take risks. And what that meant for us is that we had a lot of internal tension within our organization. And we've lost some membership over the case. And we had to shift our work from our 30 years of, we actually started around hate and police violence, around the killing of Vincent Chin and all the Asian and Southeast Asian and South Asian immigrants and refugees who were attacked by the police. That's how CAF started. But knowing that 30 years later, what the movement requires of us is take risks, and we had to make a shift so that we can build the immigrant left, so that this, what happened last year around, you know, whether it's affirmative action, police accountability, whatever it may be, that we are, what the movement requires of us is take risks to lose stuff, to lose material things so that we can win for the greater good.
So I want to pick up on a term, Kathy, that you just used, which is the immigrant left. And I think this is kind of a foundational term, because so much of the Asian American movement and solidarity comes out of the left. And so, you know, if it's fair for me to just kind of be provocative here and say, how do we build that immigrant left? You know, how do we recruit younger generations into that political trajectory? You know, Martin Luther King said, you know, an injustice anywhere is an injustice everywhere. It's like, I'm paraphrasing, I don't know if those are the exact words. But what he meant by that is that if you allow something to happen here, it's eventually going to happen over there, or it increases, elevates the power of those who have repressive authority to act in that way everywhere. Does that make sense? So it wasn't just like an appeal to our common humanity. That was certainly part of it, but it was really a call for strategy and saying, listen, if you allow this to happen here, it's going to come around. But that is an analysis that leftists hold about power, which is distinct from an analysis that liberals hold about politics, where liberals say, okay, how does this one policy affect all these different groups, and can we build a coalition around those who have common interests, right? You know, around, say, affirmative action. This is what's so, you know, to me, objectionable about Asian Americans taking an anti-affirmative action position. It's really based in self-interest. It's not based in political solidarity, right? In a sense of how, you know, what we're trying to build. Okay. So what we need to do, I think, is build a movement where more people understand that strategy of an injustice here is an injustice everywhere, which requires building, you know, a new left,
Because the left has historically been the type of people who think that way. So my question for all of you, and we're going to start with you, Kathy, is how do we just start building that base of, you know, younger, presumably, leftists who will carry this Asian American movement and solidarity forward?
Mm-hmm. We had many difficult conversations with our membership last year, like many. And we had to break down what is a system and what is an institution. And that, and connecting, and then, you know, we had the clear example, you know, when tenants are vacated from their buildings in Chinatown and they don't leave, even though that's their home from the past 30, 40 years, and they don't leave, the landlord in the city actually calls the cops to come and arrest the tenants for not leaving the home they've known for 30, 40 years because they're considered trespassing when there's a vacate order placed in the building. And making that connection to how oftentimes, you know, the law enforcement is used for tools for displacement, just as the military is used as tools of displacement around the world. And so, you know, we had those difficult conversations with our members, reminding them that, you know, when the landlord actually, when we have rallies and protests, the landlord then calls the cops and breaks up our protests. Or when the landlord breaks into their apartment building and the tenant calls the cops on the landlord, they actually do nothing about it. Even though we had one landlord, two or three actually, who had their building managers who were trying to get into the apartment building, they like broke into the window and climbed into their apartment when her children were around. She called the cops and the cops didn't do anything about it. Because who are they there to protect? They're there to protect the wealth and the landlords and people who hold wealth. And so we had to have those difficult, very challenging conversations with the members to have a deeper understanding what's the system that perpetuates the violence in our communities and upholds and protects wealth. And we can't, Kaja, one of our allies from Freedom Inc. in Wisconsin, is like, if you can't talk to grandma about patriarchy, then you don't know how to organize. And that's the thing. Like, a lot of young people think that we just go in with an analysis. That's actually never, I don't know who that's worked with, but that's never worked with our base. You can't just, like, go into a room of older immigrants or like, recent immigrants, like, this is the right way to think. It, if anything, pushes them away. And now is the time as actually to build in these conversations. And like, it's okay if people make mistakes, if they use the wrong pronouns, if they, you know, I was at the Women's March and a white man told me, go back to your country at the march, and our white allies didn't say anything, you know, to him, but it's okay. Like, this is a moment where we're trying to build left, and we need to, and it's Alicia Garza who wrote that, article, our citizens would not build a movement. There's all these critiques about the Women's March, and I understand people's frustration, but our citizens won't build a movement, and we have to be patient with one another. We have to build and build in and build big, and it takes love, it takes patience, it takes understanding, and it takes communication.
That's a big question, Eric. And part of it is because I grew up in... I was a youth organizer many, many years ago, and there was a lot of trauma through that experience as well. And growing up in the left, the Asian left, a social justice movement was a very difficult thing for me. And it's taught me many lessons, but it's also left me with many questions as well. And it is a challenge for people who, you know, I think about. I mean, similar to what our friend Kaja always says, you know, like, you can't, like, I've said this before, which is that my lived experience is my analysis. You know, it's like, it didn't come from, like, books that I've read and things like that, but I read, not that I don't read. but that the experience of, particularly the experience of living in such oppressive intersections, as well as living in anti-immigrant, anti-Asian, and like conditions, doesn't allow our people to always be woke, right? And I think particularly this moment is something that we're all taking as organization, as individual, to really awaken people, right? So for us at Mekong, for example, doing more community building work is actually more effective than winning campaigns right now for us, right? Doing the work of doing fairs, I mean, doing like things at the park, doing community building things, because fundamentally what racism, capitalism, militarism is displace you and takes away the sense of community. And what we've learned in Southeast Asian is that building a community is our act of resistance at this moment. So we are engaged in a lot of community building efforts, community gardens, we're building a senior center, all these things that we're doing, and in collaboration with other community, not just our community, we're just going to say, hey, this is our story. This is how we've been impacted by war and violence. And if we understand, and in that process, then talk about, what it means to, that if it is about dismantling white supremacy, that if it is about dismantling militarization, that we need to talk about the liberation of black people and the liberation of even native people in this country. We can't talk about the geographically, we can't do the work without that history and understanding, unpacking that, right? So we've learned a lot from the indigenous people, 7 generations to undo trauma. We're in 1 generation maybe for the Southeast Asian community here in the United States. So we have a lot of work to do. There's a lot of internal work that we need to do. But fundamentally, it is about building a revolution that's built on love and community. Building that power and that act of resistance that is beyond the day-to-day living, but it's communal, right? And then it's built on love and solidarity. So.
Thank you. So this is time I can say some our recent campaign is called Hate Free Zone. So I can explain a little bit this term, what does mean Hate Free Zone and why we decide to run this campaign. 2016 election brought about the administration that has openly committed policies and hate and include people who are openly declared white supremacist, racist, misogynist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, and proto-fascist. These are the people who are committed to getting right and eliminating all of our community. So we are not only a target or hate to the policies. This is a social force also, like an open social force to hate us. So when we start dialogue with our communities, our memberships, people are very frustrated, people crying, people really scared and angry. So when we start dialogue, first a couple of days to taking our trauma go down, and we start discuss how we can build these strong alliances to fight back. So we realize we are not strong enough to fight back against this administration. We need to deeper and broader in our communities. And also another something going on with our community when mayor or governor say, oh, sanctuary city, we are not allow eyes to read. People think mayor or politician will be safe as every single day because this is a sanctuary city. And our young undocumented leaders and organizers start dialogue. What does mean sanctuary for us? When black people will be killed in the state because of the broken window policies, what does mean sanctuary? Sanctuary only for the immigrant? So our members and communities have a dialogue, and we decide, no, sanctuary not for only the immigrant. Sanctuary could be for black people, Latino people, LGBTQ peoples, women, and immigrant. And all our community actually target black, Muslim, LGBT, women, worker, student, not just immigrant. So we think we need to build safety for all, not for only us. And we cannot even rely on the politician or famous activist. We don't believe actually heroism. No one will be safe us. we have to save each other. So that's the reasons we realize when immigrant will be left out from this country because of the deportation and detention, who will be highly impacted? Businesses, right? Because these workers actually work for small businesses. So we think not only the impacted community, who could be our allies? Businesses, small businesses could be our allies because they will be impacted. They will be lost their worker. They have to maybe pay high the white or other workers. So this could be our allies. Ethnic or religious are supposed to be our allies. We think who will be our base, who will be our impacted community, leading front line this campaign, and who could be our allies, who could be support this movement, and how we can build strong alliances to fight back. So this idea came up, lot of thing, and people came as, oh, we can launch Trump Free Zone, and it's a back and forth dialogue. Oh no, the name will be actually if we put this name, then we will be lost maybe some of our neighbors, white or black immigrant and citizen. We don't want. We want actually make larger our alliances. So we came up idea we can launch Hate Free Zone is a neighborhood safety campaign. How neighbors can save each other. So last December we launched our campaign. So second time maybe I can talk a couple of component how our Hate Free Zone functioning now.
That's a really good question. How do we build the emerging left? How do we support folks? I think for me, I like to simplify things. So for me, it's really about compassion, curiosity, and community. Compassion in that not everyone's going to get, you know, all of the terms right. That folks aren't going to, like Kathy and other folks have said, have an analysis. We use woke a lot now. And for those of us that have been doing the work for a long time, I want to go to sleep. I'm tired of being woke. We just need to take a really long nap.
Just go nap.
I think it's really about realizing that not people are not born with this analysis, right? It has to be developed. A curiosity about where they're coming from. I don't like call-out culture because it automatically shuts folks down. And usually when folks call me out publicly, I ask them, did that make you feel better about yourself? You know, is this about education or is this about you trying to be more down than I am? Curiosity helps to frame things. If someone says something messed up, I'm like, can you tell me what that means? I used to do this a lot with Tibetan youth when they'd be like, oh, that's so gay, that's so gay. What does that mean? Oh, it's, you know, it's dumb. I was like, well, that's, what does that mean? So it's just like really coming at it from a place of curiosity rather than attack. And then lastly, community. No one wants to be doing this work 24/7. We need a community. We need to have a party. We need to have conversations over good food. Human beings are communal creatures. If we are to build a new left, then there, folks need to see a place where they're at. And part of that is building, as Instagram calls them, influencers, which are individuals that are able to speak to a mass audience. We need to be able to speak to as many people as possible, and that's about building the grassroots on up. So, yeah.
So I do want to open it up for Q&A, but before I do, real quickly wanted to get from the panelists their wish list, like a minute each. And I'll explain what I mean by that right now. So, you know, in the last round, a couple of things came up that, you know, people that you're dealing with in your base, Kathy, or folks who are living in precarious housing conditions where heat and hot water could be shut off at a moment's notice. Chaya talked about the lingering traumas that people are still dealing with, right, that have yet and probably will, you know, never be fully resolved, right? Kazi talked about people being scared, you know, what will happen to me next under this administration? And then Kalyan talking about the need for community. What all of this suggests is that we need a resourced movement. We need people being taken care of in order for us to succeed. And actually, the historical data comports with this. If you think about communities that have engaged in the most radical protests in acts of insurgency, like
That's
this,
right.
in about a week, we're going to celebrate the beginning of the long hot 50th anniversary of the long hot summer, where like hundreds of cities erupted in major unrest in 1967. When we went back and looked at the data, we found out that the cities that saw the most intense disruptions were not the ghettos that where people were most deprived. You would think that that's the case. Actually, it was ghettos where there was moderate deprivation. Meaning what? That those who were able to engage in uprisings had some level of organization, resource, and community care that allowed them to take it to the streets. Does that make sense?
Right. No.
You can't actually engage in organized activity if you're completely deprived.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
This brings me to my last question, a minute each. What do you need in your organizations? What could people resource you with? Anyone can go in any order.
You only get 1 minute?
Yes. Or just because you want people to, you know, their attention spans, you know, you're just here's our list.
I think the one critical thing for us is that we have movements. It's not just one movement. So whether it's the labor movement, the housing movement, the immigration movement, all of us cannot undercut one another. And that if one sector is going to win, it comes at the expense of another if they're going to move forward. And so our wish list is that when we do this work, whether it's academia or in labor organizing or housing organizing, that we do this in coordination with one another and where we don't undercut one another. Someone will always lose if it's just, someone will always lose. Just like that poem, when they came for the, what was that again? When they come for the socialists, I'm blanking how it started, but I think the same applies for our organizing in our sectors. So what our wish list is that in our work, that when justice is not just us, justice is for humanity. So that's our wish list. But more concretely in how you can support our work is to donate to grassroots groups who are on the ground doing the work, and seeing that it takes patience, it takes love, it takes communication, and it takes time. Opal from Baji and BLM was saying there's no shortcuts to democracy, to building democracy. There is no shortcuts to building a base and building the left. And having, for funders especially, having that patience and to invest in this long-term gain and win.
I agree, you know, fund the movement, fund the organization, fund the grassroots organizations. And when we were talking about community, one of the things, when we first began to visualize what MakeCon would look like, three things we said was that we needed to build an organization and a movement that gave people a sense of connectedness, safety, and dignity. And the movement and the organization and our day-to-day practice should look like that. So even in a personnel manual, you should read it. It's actually awesome. It took many years, 5 years, to develop. But everything that we do is centered around those three things. And the question around, what else people can do, I think API, East Asians, y'all need to show up for Southeast Asian a little bit more. So I'm calling that because we have many, many campaigns and many things happening. We have a campaign called the Right to Return campaign that are being led by folks who's been deported back to Cambodia, by Southeast Asian, by Cambodian people, but also in the United States, there, the Vietnamese community, the Laotian community, and the Cambodian community have come together to really take on the repatriation agreement and the deportations of Cambodian as a is our movement issue right now for the Southeast Asian movement. So yes, show up for us too. And I think that 60 years ago when API was coined this term, I don't know if Southeast Asian were part of that. And I'm hoping moving forward that our narrative and our analysis become part of that movement. So building the new left means that we want to be part of those conversations and movement as well, and discussions as well. And South Asian.
I totally agree with Kathy. Our organization actually ran immigration movement, worker rights campaign, and racial profiling for all color of people. Even as an identity, we are South Asian working class immigrant. We are worker. We are Muslim and as usual women also. We have a lot of youth folks who identify LGBTQ community. How we cannot separate each of my identity? Also, we have to think, we don't want anything expensive of other people cost. When we fight as immigrant worker and Muslim, we have to think about Black, Latino, and LGBTQ folks. Nothing supposed to came from cut of other people's justice. So this is supposed to be, we always take care, and always as Asian Pacific Islander identity, we have to always think how can we build great alliances with Black and Latino folks and fight for our justice.
The question was like, what resources, right? What do we need to do the work? I'm going to take a different approach. Organizations like Amnesty need decolonization. Decolonization like a wave out of the West Philippine Sea, spreading over a beach, lifting up every single grain with its warm saltiness and cleansing it. What decolonization means is understanding that we are part of an intrinsic link. What happens to one group affects another group. And if we do not take responsibility for that, then we are going to be the architects of our own demise. I think that there needs to be, as many water protectors in Standing Rock said, an indigenization of folks in the global north. And a very deep, deep kind of reframing and repositioning of ourselves and our sense of responsibility to the world. I know that's like kind of wavy gravy, but it's not like, oh, donate more. It's like, decolonize your minds is all I really want to say to more of these organizations.
Okay, so there you have it. You need to fund the movement. You need to show up. And you need to get us some decolonization while you're at it. And with that, we'll take your questions. You could queue up along these microphones if you have questions, thoughts you want to share. Hi. There you go.
You know, I'd like to ask you a question for all of the panelists, and that's, why have you accepted definitions of certain homonyms that are really against the Asian and Pacific Islander communities ever succeeding? Because if you look at right, is white is right. But if you look at right, we always talk about the right, and they are in the major power structure, the right. But if you look at the left, the left is left behind, or we strive to be the left. So we strive to be left behind and left out. Is that what we really want to do? So I think we have fallen into sort of a trap of self-definition that is really quite defeating, self-defeating in a way, because left has never been really accepted in the U.S. as being part of the center. So, you know, it was maybe 1960s when some of us were fighting to integrate the New York City public schools. That was a pretty foolhardy experiment. But anyway, we tried to do that. So we had a demonstration, and Stokely Carmichael and H. Rapp Brown joined us. And how did the New York Times define me? They said, and there was a Chinese communist housewife in the picket line. Now, I was a little offended because he did not come to me and ask me, was I Chinese? Was I a communist? Was I a housewife? All those definitions that they came up to me, I couldn't possibly have been anything else but something that was wrong or left or whatever. So I would like to ask all of you, how have you accepted the term left? or how do you use the term right as in correct? Are we not correct? So if we're correct in that use of the term, then we are the right and not the left. So I'd like to ask you how you have...
I so appreciate that question. It's funny because I have these conversations with my partner. He's like, the right wing has one agenda, and that's money. Money and white supremacy, but money. And capitalism is the root of all of that. And the left, we are so confused. We are on the spectrum of so many different strategies and analyses, and it's rough being on the left. But we also have agency to own the left. Like, this is what we're building. And, you know, it's the conversations we have with our staff all the time who struggle with it. And I think one thing's for certain is the left is working towards humanity. And we have to remind ourselves over and over again, what does humanity look like? And we don't want to fight each other on the left to work towards humanity, because what good does that good do for the work? So even if we disagree with another organization who's on the left, we're not going to attack them. You know, we'll have these conversations with them if we can, because they have to be moved too. You know, for a while I was really frustrated with some of the bigger organizations who made deals with the mayor. But we don't publicly denounce them. We have conversations because they also have to be organized. Because what good does it do for the left in our movement if we are just doing the work of the right for them?
Yeah, I can answer. If I tell you the honest answer is I was born as a left. I have no choice because my father was a left leader and he cannot read Urdu. He cannot read Bangla because he was grew up in 32 years Pakistan, so he read only Urdu. But after liberation, we have to move Bangladesh, and he actually encouraged me to reading when I was only 3 or 4 years old. And I have to read all left newspaper for him, and I grew up as a left. But the political answer is, it's not mean who have a power, who have a money, and who have a resources. It's mean for me who is right, who is wrong. I always think right is a wrong side and left is a right side. If you see the fascist movement always come with popularity. They have a lot of support, a lot of people. Does not mean fascism is a right side. So that not important how many people we are the left side. Is important. We are the right side, actually. We always right side, and left believe working class power, working class leading, and working class empowerment. That's why I decide to go to the left side.
You can go.
I'm going to put my amnesty hat on for a second. As a human rights organization, we are actually, first of all, I want to say thank you for your work that you have done and continue to do, and bring this question up. The way we approach it is that everyone deserves human rights, and that could be contested. Some people are assholes and don't deserve it, like neo-Nazis. But that's not the view of my organization. I think that it's. You're right, we do need to start to increase the center and see people who are in the center as part of a broader movement to show them that their interests, their self-interests of themselves and their family are tied to, you know, for lack of a better term, leftist politics.
Well, when you said left, the thing that came up to me, Suki, and Suki is an amazing leader in our work in New York City, so thank you. For me, it's really about justice. I think that, you know, it's not just about equality, it's really about justice. So who leads, who should be in the front of the fight is queer, young women, you know? And so for me, I have been challenged with that for a very long time, and one of the movement that really inspired me is the LGBT community looking at everything in spectrum. We are living spectrums, right? So not everything is always left or right. And I have these discussions with my husband as well who, you know, who's like, everything is black and white. I'm like, nope, not everything is black and white, not even the movement. So to really think about our life and the work and our campaigns in a spectrum also allow us to move people and to move each other. Because there are moments when you think that you've taken the right position, and then you have to check yourself because you've just experienced what just happened was an internalized oppression where you feel, you know, so there's all these other things that exist. So left and right is, I think, for the sake of placing things. But for me, and my organization and our movement, it's really about building a movement of justice and humanity. So I would love to erase that word too, Suki, so you and I can do that together in your city.
We absolutely need new terminology. There's no question. We got to get out of the binary. I think the only term that has not been co-opted by the center or the right is one that Mark used earlier, which is liberation. I think that has a specifically kind of radical valence still that that doesn't drift into other things. So I don't know, maybe what we're talking about is how do we build a new Asian American liberated or liberate, I don't know. We can work on this over lunch. But the last thing I'll say, to be honest with you, and I know this is probably not going to be popular with everyone, but a Chinese communist housewife is someone I want to know. I'm sorry. That, to me, is like A+. Other questions, thoughts, comments? Yes.
I'm a student at Brooklyn College and have two questions. So is there a moment or a person or a chain of events that compel you to do the work you're doing right now? And also, it's hard to be always woke. So what motivates you and gives you the strength to continue doing the work you are doing in your organization and communities?
I think for me, I think for me it's always, I always go back to community. So like, you know, even we talk about self-care and things like that. People talk about going to the spa. But for me, it's like food, cooking, you know, going back to my people and really listening and learning and engaging and unlearning different things together. And I truly want to live the movement. I don't just want to run an organization. Unfortunately, we've been, all of us are stuck in this 501c3 complex where we have to raise money, we have to
contracts.
To do contracts and staff and all that stuff, but I truly want to live the movement. And for me, it is about being at home, being community, and I also have three kids, you know, and who for anything I've learned over the years, and I think, you know, Eric and I talk about this too because we have kids, and it's like they ask the most clearest question and they will hold me accountable at all times. And that's the kind of movement I want, where there is a level of accountability and responsibility that I feel. And at times it conflicts with the 501c3 model. And we're all of us, I think, I would say, are challenged every day around, you know, following those protocols, but also living the movement. And I think for me, living the movement means very different things for different people. But for me, it's always about going back to my community, and really teaching and unlearning these things together.
For the second part of the question, how do you maintain yourself? Being woke is not, or being aware, being conscious is, it's difficult. Human beings cannot do that for more than, 18 hours without starting to lose their ability to think. I think one of the things that helps with sustainability is rooting yourself in joy and possibility. Because there are many times when you have been told that, you know, everything's falling apart, the world is shit, and we're all just gonna die. Okay, yeah, that might be true if you look at it in a certain way. But also there's beauty out there. There is just being with your community and having a laugh together, having good food, dancing. Find the things that make us human. Find the things that bring us happiness, and really, really grounding yourself in that.
I want to talk about the motivation part. Motivation, actually, every single day we got some motivation to do this work. But I was undocumented 4.5 years and was a retail worker, seamstress, Jackson Heights, and I had an accident and My right shoulder is broken and six fracture. I did not get any medications or good treatment because undocumented status and no health insurance. That's something actually motivate me to do these works and join DRAM as an organizer. But lot of motivation going every single day, with every single organizer. If I want to say just recent, two example, we had a detention hangari strike last year's, 11 detention, the nationwide hangari strike. Every single day I had a call, 70 to 150 call from detention detainee, California to Florida people, speak Urdu, Bangla, Hindi, Nepali, even Spanish speaking people call me. I don't know how to communicate with them. Every single person wants help. And by this hangari strike, 44 detainees was released. They are in New York now. They are now DRAM members. And when I saw them, they are doing work in pizza shops, restaurant, delivery boy, earn money and send back home for family. There's something motivate me every single day. Recently, now online fundraising going on. The one of the boy tried to cross Panama and U.S. border and he actually drowned and dead and body not found 9 days and U.S. Border Patrol actually found his body after 9 days. Family somehow collect my number and call me to find out his body. And we ask them, who is border? They don't know nothing. And we say, Mexico and U.S. is a long border. How can we even investigate and try to find this? We don't know actually. And we try to find out his body after 3 months. We finally found his body. And we actually call family, let them know we found his body, but we need money, $8,000. And DRAM have no money to pay $8,000. And I ask my community, every single working class worker actually donating money now to send this body. All story actually motivate me to work every single day. Never actually motivation end.
Kazi is hands down one of the strongest organizers you'll meet in Jackson Heights, by the way. Doing this work is very isolating, and it's very lonely sometimes. But I think in recent months, especially after the election of Trump, people were very demoralized. Our tenants were very demoralized because they feel like they're losing on every front. And, you know, I wrote a love letter to my staff because they're feeling demoralized, too, because they're the ones holding the members' really demoralized feelings. I encourage people to find inspiration every day. So I was like, your color coding inspires me. You know, your optimism inspires me. You know, we have to appreciate and inspire one another to keep us in this work. And, my family comes from Vietnam, refugee camps, you know, my mom and dad never went to school. They taught themselves how to read and write and like raised two children who went to college. You know, my dad lived through 3 occupations in Vietnam, Japan, the U.S. and French. And so, and he's been through his challenges, but his existence inspires me. His fight to want to live inspires me. And that's why we have to proactively heal. We have to proactively heal so that we can build resiliency. If we don't heal through cooking or therapy or
karaoke.
Art or karaoke or dancing. We had a karaoke battle Saturday, by the way. It was amazing. You guys should donate and come next year. If we don't proactively heal, we don't build resiliency to keep on with this work. And one thing that helps me is actually, like, you know, sometimes as an ED, you're just so bound by, like, all the work and the contracts and the grants and stuff. But I actually, you know, did a study session. I was doing a series of study sessions to learn about the war and learn about Ho Chi Minh's leadership in Vietnam and Southeast Asia. And, like, learning that history and putting that in the context of now and the long haul and the vision of the future, you know, just learning about our history and reading about Ho Chi Minh, reading about Che and Fidel and reading about, you know, the revolutionary suicide by Huey P. Newton and just having a global context of our struggle is what keeps me in for the long haul. And the last thing I'll touch on is that this work is not about individual self. It's about shared leadership. The more that you're not making decisions, the more that you're making decisions with others and other people making decisions, your members, your staff, your volunteers, that is how you keep yourself in the work and you develop others to lead with you.
Okay, at this point, I want to thank the panel and ask your indulgence if you would allow us to have the two people with questions or comments to make their questions and comments quickly, and then one or two of you each respond to it, and then we'll close it off, and then we'll go to lunch where you get a chance to really talk to one another. So may I?
So we'll stack the questions.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Preet Verdi. I spoke earlier. I'm a PhD from SOAS in the UK. My question is coming from a community organizing perspective in Manhattan. As an organizing member for the Manhattan Sikh Association, which is mostly a religious organization that comes together twice a month, I identify a strong desire amongst the people who attend that they want to do something more. But at the same time, I also identify this model minority complex where there's this class mobility happening within the Sikh community. And, you know, these are the future doctors, lawyers, whatever, of tomorrow. And so I see this disconnect between the grassroots mobilization that needs to happen across class, but this sort of barrier that exists at the same time. So I wanted to know if you had any suggestions how we could address that. Thank you.
Thank you. And the next question.
Hello, everyone. My name is Raj. I'm one of the academic advisors in one of the CUNY institutions. I'm from Queens College. First, I want to thank AARI for putting this event together. I think it's a wonderful opportunity for us to connect across different organizations, campuses, wherever we're working with young people. So I really appreciate this is my first event, so I'm really happy to be here. And I also want to thank the panelists because as community organization, you guys are doing great work in preparing the next generation of people to lead us into, you know, the new world. And I want to actually piggyback on the last question about, you know, this whole idea of model minority. And also from the previous panel, this, you know, invisibility issue that our students deal with. So, you know, it's great that we want to work with other organizations, but I think there's a sense of identity that our youth doesn't have, right? Because when they're walking into these campuses, now more than ever, there's a perception of our students, right? We are a model minority. We take advantage of the programs that exist in institutions and organizations. So when our kids are dealing with that dynamic of institutions, how do we instill in them a sense of identity and being active in their community when they're walking into institutions that don't necessarily support their own individual identity, but rather perceive them as somehow a threat to this new world?
All I can say is, well, good luck.
Can I add my question?
Sure, Bob, you just stepped in.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I'm late. I just thank you so much for doing a Pan-Asian event. I haven't heard so much of this since Basement days, when Basement was utterly, we were very much Pan-Asian in the very beginning. Unfortunately, that lost steam. So it's nice to see you guys trying to revive it now. But I just need to make an announcement to let you know that there is not just a Pan-Asian thing happening in the city, but a city-wide community borough thing happening. The city is about to pass a law on culture that's going to last 10 years and re-in-place the inequity for people of color and all diversity in the city. And we, so many of us who have been victims of the city's inequitable plans for 40 years, have decided to put out our own plan, which is the People's Cultural Plan. We need your support for that plan. All the different communities across the borough need you to endorse this plan at the peoplesculturalplan.org. You can write to us at peoplesculturalplan.gmail. But this is an incredible moment. We haven't had this opportunity in so many decades to fight the city on a level in which embarrasses them perhaps enough to get some beginnings of a platform that we hope will last us for the next year or more.
Thank you, Bob. Okay.
I try to answer, actually. If somebody asks me, as an organizer, what is your big struggle or challenges, of always without thinking I say class struggle, because we organize people here working class who is not working class back home, actually. They are banker, doctor, engineer, middle class businessman. When they came this country and find job as a retail worker, restaurant worker, domestic worker, taxi or any kind of candy store, they actually send kids in the school. They never talk with them, a model minority meet. They never talk with them. They are very privileged group in the school. They always think their kids are very intelligent. Also, they are very good parents, actually. That's the reason their kids are getting better result. And they actually push their kids to go middle class identity. I mean, doctor, nurse, any kind of good profession. They anyhow to actually want to shift from Jamaica to Long Island and good residential area. This is their struggle, actually, how they send their kids actually better places and not anymore working class identity. Drum actually really facing this challenge always. So we run summer internship program every single year. Since 2003, 20 to 25 kids got a community justice training. Every single year, I'm the person actually go in the state with the big groups, show them what does mean vendor, what does mean restaurant worker, what does mean retail worker. They talk with our members and worker, and they always share their feelings. My dad is restaurant worker. I never knew he do that kind of hard work. He never share with me this. My mom is a domestic worker. She never share with me. I mean, our parents never share their experiences and struggle and challenges with their kids because they don't want to hurt them. They don't want to lesson what does mean working class. So as an organization, we try to give actually our youth generation that kind of political education and life experiences, what does mean working class. May or may not be, they will be working class anymore, but they don't supposed to forget their parents' struggle or working class struggle ever. They could be lawyer, they could be doctor, but they never supposed to be forget those class struggle, and they always commit to do services or work for those people.
Thank you. Would someone else want to answer one of the other questions? And then I'm sorry you've been listening with rapt attention, but we do need to move on. Please.
We just to add to what Kazi said, we can never rely on institutions to help us form any of our identity or our politics. That we encourage people to get involved with organizations outside of these institutions. And the thing about class mobility, you know, there's a surge of like the Chinese for Trump, Hindus for Trump, and they're really annoying. But they're also being manipulated by the right, the white right wing, the Republicans that are controlling and giving them resources to do this work. But the mass working class will be always outnumbered, even with those within our own communities who move up. And that class mobility will never protect them from white supremacy, that at the end of the day, we're still not white when we go to the middle of America. And so that is the work that, but we also have to center and always remember that we have to move within the working class space, because we will always outnumber the people who even move up, and remind them that their class isn't going to protect them from white supremacy.
Makes me think about this conversation we had maybe 10 years ago, Eric, around creating an Asian X movement, talking about and eliminating all those identities that really challenges you, including class, the Mara minority myth. And that's all I'll say. But this makes me think a lot around what the future of the Asian movement looked like in this country. So
sounds like
I hope
the next conference.
That conversation. Yeah.
Next conference. Eric, would you like to close?
You know, and let's just keep in mind that the so-called Muslim ban, the executive order, right? which essentially stripped the rights of all of these international migrants, didn't care about class. I mean, in that instance, right, it didn't quite matter. I think we should sound off on that. And a lot of what is happening mm-hmm. by way of stripping people of their rights under this administration cuts across class. So we do need to stay on message around that. Mm-hmm. And with that, I want to have you all join me in thanking this wonderful panel for enlightening us this afternoon. And, you know, we'll transition into lunch and hopefully have some more conversation over food, right?
Right. Thank you very much. So with this, we're going to move on to the lunch. It's a buffet lunch. I wish it were the kind of food that really fed our soul. But it's good enough for today. It's within budget. And please make sure you talk to someone you do not know. And we'll be back here for the final session at 2 p.m. Thank you.